and searched the jungle for 5 days, murdered the people, and dragged them back into the camp. That's why you see drag marks. That's why you see bodies in rows on top of sheets. That's why you see bodies in neat rows, face down and in calm repose. These people did not die of cyanide poisoning. They did not drink cyanide. If they had, they would have shown two indisputable signs of cyanide pathology. Spasming of the limbs because you're getting interference for the messages from the brain to the muscles. All right, and you start to jerk, your back brain stuff too, you breathe in, and then you can't get breath because nothing's working the way it's supposed to. Your limbs start to jerk, and so you're going to end up with a rigor in a spasmodic position. The second is a grin, a sardonic death grin known as cyanide rictus. The mouth muscles draw back into this tight grin. It's not present on any picture where I can see a face. Dr. Mutu looked at the bodies and he said that 80 to 90% were forcibly injected, broken needles, evidence of forceful injection, in the back of their left shoulder blade with something. The rest, he said, were shot or strangled. The Guinness grand jury on site, Matthews Ridge, based on his testimony and the direct evidence, said that there was not a single suicide at Jonestown. This idea that mass suicides are common human practice is an absolute fallacy. I even went back to Masada, which they put on the TV shortly after Jonestown, to support it. The Masada history of the supposed mass Jewish suicide, and Josephus, the Roman historian, admits that only a small group of the Jews, like 12 or 20 in that range, killed themselves and the rest were slaughtered by the Roman troops when they arrived. So there was a small suicide pact, but they didn't come in on a mass human suicide situation. The only other story I was able to unearth through time in Guyana, this mass suicide, had been written 100 years before and was probably the basis of this story. A missionary named Smith, Smith and Jones, a missionary named Smith in the 1860s takes the Carib Indians cut loose from the earlier colonized sugar plantations that they helped to guard and surround it. They move up into the Orinoco River Valley. They're migrant. This missionary tells them that he's got a revivalist religion. All the plants are going to grow fivefold. They're going to live in paradise. After 5 years of being lied to, they're getting rather disgruntled. They're starving up there. And so he says, well, I got it wrong. At first, I've had another vision, and first you have to die. Then after you all die, you'll come back as white people, and then you'll live in paradise. And so supposedly then up there on Matthews Ridge in 1860, there was a mass suicide by these Carib Indians, probably killed by the state, but whatever happened to them, they're supposedly mass suicide. But you know, if you ask the old Nazis how the Jews died in the camps, they'll tell you it was a mass suicide too. They have a German word for it, Lebensmüde. It means sick of death. The Jews got sick of death, the Nazis say, and they killed themselves in the camps. So that's what you're being told about Jonestown. It's as much of a lie at Waco. First of all, you have to believe that one minister that could convince everybody in the group to kill themselves. If you can get past that supposition, then you have to believe in Waco that the method by which they would decide to kill themselves is fire. Fire, the most painful possible way to die. And then if you'll buy those two premises, there's something else operating. I don't care what this 5% of the cells has decided. When that heat hits, the other 95% are heading for the door. Why didn't anybody come out? What were they doing? Sitting and burning alive like Buddhist monks, self-immolating, you know, in protest of what? There wasn't anything going on. This is all a creation of the government. They planted the FBI as the only source for the mass suicide rumor. It's more of the same nonsense. They're covering up on how these things happen. These people were murdered, just as the bodies in Jonestown were murdered. It was the largest black genocide operation to that date. And when I went into the backgrounds of the top people at Jonestown, the Buford family, the Layton family, I found again connections to the top military intelligence office and naval intelligence. Layton's father ran chemical biological warfare out of Dugway from 56 to 63 for the US government and gave $50 million at least for the operation down in Jonestown. This is Dr. Lawrence W. Layton. Buford, who married into the Layton family, her father was head of Navy intelligence for the whole 7th Fleet out of Philadelphia. The families interrelate also with their major stock investors in Solvay Drugs, which is IG Farben, the Nazi cartel that made the gas for the Jews in the chambers and put Hitler in power. All of this, the move situation, Jonestown was setting the stage for Waco. I'm sure you've heard the parallels that I'm laying out here for the idea that this was a religious leader isn't proven. or that this was even a religious community. The Branch Davidians that broke off from the Seventh-day Adventists were the pacifist sect of the religion. They believed that the Seventh-day Adventists weren't pacifist enough. So how did this become the armed camp? Was Koresh just a religious fanatic, or is he like Jones, someone who, when we go into it, will be found to have an intelligence background, a sleeper of some sort, a control agent? Did Jones die? The body taken out of Guyana doesn't show the trademark tattoo on the chest. Did Koresh die? There were questions early on. First reports on CNN, 26 escaped from the fire. There were tunnels. Remember the one guy in the middle of the seats that got out to the shed? How did he get past the police line? There were tunnels out of the situation. How many people were allowed to leave? Who was killed? How were they identified? Maybe Koresh was killed, you know, and left in the situation. Did somebody get out? Remember the count discrepancies like Jonestown? There were supposedly 92 people there, or 93, and first they could only find 70 bodies. What did they do just the other day? Bulldozed the whole compound, just like the move house. Now we can't establish any independent forensic or ballistic or identification evidence because the police demolition team has finished history there at Waco for us. We have only the official story, and that's what we're supposed to believe. We sit quietly, a group of people are attacked without any reason. Were they after Koresh? Koresh went jogging that morning. The ATF could have picked them up. They followed him in and out of town for weeks. They had infiltrators, many of them who survived the fire, just as the Jonestown survivors. Because there were 1,100 to 1,200 people at Jonestown, but there's only 915 dead in the final count. And there's only 13 official survivors at Jonestown. Where are the rest? Where are the trained killers that operated the concentration camp at Jonestown? Where were they moved to? One place was Grenada, and they ran operations there out of the mental hospital that was bombed, and were doing testing. Jones's son went there and other top lieutenants. Some of them went, I believe, into the kill squads in South America. But these people are interchangeable. The future cults that we'll be told to swallow are the new Islamic terrorist cells that are going to blow up the New York tunnel and blow up the... All of this is part of a strategy of tension to create fear, to create a new enemy. Now that communism is gone, the new enemy is the independent bungling terrorist who can't get his bombs right, who tries to get money back on his van after he blows up the New York four times. He goes back to get his return, and it's all based on evidence, or at least we'll call it evidence. Well, it's sort of like the expert said, the bomb that they had was exactly sort of like the other bomb. So if you looked at these two, I'm quoting, if you looked at these two bombs, that you'd say, is that like that? And you'd say, yes. This is expert testimony on the connections. They had almost no evidence, and yet they're willing to go and bomb Iraq one more time, which tells you also, I think, that Clinton's not in charge. And Clinton's Secret Service cars were right next to the place that the bomb went off. He was going up there on Monday. I think they sent him a little message, you know, either play the game out in Iraq the way you want us to in the Middle East, or, you know, because he's going toward Dayton, trying to calm things down, and the military's saying, no, you're not going to be a draft dodger this time. You've got to take the forces of the world into their natural conclusion. So the idea is that we can't establish any alternative lifestyle. We have to live in distrust and fear of each other. We have to, as my friend Lori in California wears this great button that says, keep quiet, consume, and die. The space between our ears and our history itself is a commodity of the national security state. We can't have a counterculture or a counter-economy. We can't survive. We have to sit back and watch in silence as genocide goes on worldwide, as indigenous cultures are smashed, as the economy goes to ruin and we all become useless eaters, as terrorism, and especially I think now what's being touted as an atomic terrorist scenario, will be the next level, so that we can go to martial law without any qualms, and then maybe alternative three, so that the select elite can get off the planet to Mars and the moon and leave us behind in the mess that they've left. But I'm not a pessimist. Because they do all this realizing the enormous strength of the enemy that they actually face. Not the third world, they're not afraid of them. Not communism, which has fallen on its knees and carrying out the dullest plan of exploitation for the 1940s. They only have one enemy left. You and me. Us. And we're the most fearful enemy they can imagine. They wouldn't go to these lengths if they didn't think we were dangerous. And once we catch on and take our minds back and our lives back, and say no, then the gig's up.
Yeah, boy.
I guess if anybody's still awake, we can have questions and answers.
Yeah, I got one.
Yes.
In this vast corpus of information you've given us, virtually everything in society seems to be dominated and controlled by conspiracy. Yet at the beginning of your speech, you mentioned that you didn't necessarily believe in a conspiracy. Is there a conspiracy or not?
What I said is I don't believe there's one conspiracy. I said I think there's competing conspiracies. I don't mind being called a conspiracy theorist as long as you call the mainstream historians coincidence theorists. Otherwise, we're all historians working on history, and I don't mind being called a revisionist. A conspiracy theorist is someone who makes more connections than you do. That's all it is. Just like an anarchist is somebody who wants less government than you do. And it's a pejorative term that's used to discredit me and somehow credit the coincidence believers. Certainly, I think that things are connected and they work, but not as six people in a boardroom planning out human history. It has to do, in the end, with a fairly easily traceable concentration of wealth. What fascism represented in Nazi Germany in the Ruhr Valley in those years was a concentration of wealth in a very few hands, a destruction of the worth of the economy and the means of exchange, failing of the banks and the dollar, the time, the mark, and an attitude based on the level of industrialization, which we have now here as well, certainly, tenfold, that labor was expendable and that a certain segment of the population wasn't useful. This was the beginning of the idea that people were taking up space and that there were useless eaters that could be identified within the biases of the society at the time. That's the development of fascism and the Holocaust. It's not something that arises because a little nut with a brown mustache and a swastika on his arm thinks that everybody should die. It's an economic and political reality, and I believe we live under a very advanced stage of techno-fascism in this period. But we're blinded to it by the lies that that same system tells us. We're blinded into thinking that we live in a democracy. All a democracy means to George Bush and the rulers at the top is a system that protects their privilege. And all that communism means to them, or terrorism, or whatever it is you... Because now, I mean, I must be a terrorist by their definition. If a liberal is treated as a bit dirty word like a communist in the 50s, then a radical must be a terrorist. So, I'll take responsibility for being a conceptual terrorist. I don't carry bombs around, I don't bomb people or shoot people, and I don't think you can beat them at that game. You can't beat them at the pop gun game. You've got to beat them up here. You've got to take that control away from them, so that the guns don't matter. You can't arm yourself enough or build the barricade that's going to stop this level of technology. You can get the people who are asked to do that death dealing to turn those guns around, and it's happened in history. And you can do the first most important thing, I think, is to tell your own story to each other, because part of what we've lost is the trust to tell each other the history of our own lives. And if we did, much of this would break down. I found out that the main scrub nurse for the leading American lobotomist, Dr. Friedman, who performed 5,000 lobotomies himself and developed the transorbital knife, was my Aunt Jay, who worked in Washington. I just happened to mention his name at a Christmas gathering, and it came out. I didn't know that before, but those family connections are there for all of us. We all have secrets our parents don't tell us, we don't tell each other, but if we did, much of the control would break down immediately. We're told to distrust each other and not tell anybody what we do or who we are, and to live in little units and protect ourselves. So yes, I think there's a conspiracy, although I think the word from the Latin means to breathe together, and some people have worse breath than others. I conspire too, not on their level, but I conspire for consciousness and for a change. So it doesn't mean that much to me, but yes, there's concentrations of wealth and concentrations of power in the society, and they reside in fewer and fewer hands, and they are the basis for an emergence of fascism in a society, and that's what I think we live under.
So there's obviously groups in the government and groups outside the government supporting these groups in the government who are subverting the Constitution.
Well, more than that. The Constitution is a piece of paper hermetically sealed and protected underneath the National Archive floor at night and up above the floor for you to see it during the day. That's about all the protection the Constitution has left. Besides, the Constitution was written by a bourgeois class in that period of landowners who didn't like blacks and they didn't like women, and they had a certain level of privilege themselves. We don't need a Constitution, we need democracy. We have the technology right now, if we took it back, because it's public airwaves, to have control of 30% at least of all public radio and TV airtime to publicly debate issues so that every point of view could get out. And we have the power, even under the old Constitution, for two things very important, never used: recall, to throw the bums out, and referendum, to decide ourselves. Because it's too complex a society to have representative democracy. That dates back to the 1700s, when you have to go by wagon and you can't find out, you take the SOB you like the least and put them on the wagon and send them up there to tell you what happens in Philadelphia. That's not today. We have instantaneous communication travel. We know what's happening. What we're being told, that we have to elect a representative for millions of people who can't represent any of them. Doesn't even try to represent any of them, because when he's elected, he becomes the people. Does he come and ask you what you think, or me? Would we think the same? Could he represent us, thinking how different? No. You can best represent you, and I can best represent me with the power of direct democracy. And we have the technology, and we have a tremendous need for that. It has to be in the context of free flow of information and education, and we have to control that media as well. But that, and a change in the economy, because this economy is gone. If you're still looking to find something out of this, I want to tell you, the SOLs went first, the banks go next, the money is gone, and a lot of people are going to die if they latch their fortune to this economy. We need to develop ethical systems of credit and extend credit to each other. And that can be done. And then the third most central question is the question of land, because we can't survive with the land being constantly taken over by agribusiness and concentrated the way it is. Land needs to be taken back and put into trusts, and the people who live on those trusts for the 99 years of the trust decide what happens to the land. And then it also has to be in the broader picture. You know, you don't use arable land to make a parking lot when you have people starving. I mean, there's some ethics to land use too that are generalized, but we need a different approach to society. And I don't think the way to get there is to form a vanguard party and try and take over the government. You don't want the government. Get rid of the damn government. The government is in the way of democracy. And what we have to do is conspire to own our own lives.
I lived in Carmel Valley for many years, and I listened to Mae Russell's last broadcast. I also used to listen to Dave Emery. And I can't for the life of me figure out why he had an axe to grind against you.
Well, I wish I knew. The only thing I could figure out was that Dave was mad that May left me the collection, although he had no plans that I could tell. I just think it was almost like a sibling rivalry. May Russell left her collection to me to develop a center, and another researcher who worked for her for many years, Dave Emery, from the minute I got there, was agent baiting me. He now says I'm connected to the Manson family, that I'm part of the SLA, that I took all the names back and gave them to Western Goals, a right-wing group, that I turned over all the information over to the Nazis so they could kill everybody, that I'm a government agent, you know, and et cetera. I don't know. I mean, I feel sad. I mean, because Dave had done some work that I thought was important, and he followed May's trail, and he was onto things. But from the minute I got there, he was an enemy. Even at the gravesite, he said to May, speaking into the grave to May, "For your sake, I'll bury the sword against John Judge." Well, I didn't even know he had a sword out against me. He was somebody that I tried to get on the radio when I could and promoted his tapes for years and didn't fight him. But when I got close to him, I found he had many, you know, reactionary attitudes, and also, yeah, it is. It's, you know, but it became, and there are a lot of people that heard Dave Emery have never heard me, and that distrust me because he says I stole $50,000. I mean, I lost close to $20,000 trying to make it work with my own money. So, I mean, you know, if I stole any of that money, it was my money I was stealing back for myself.
John, I've been around since about 1980, the Maharaja Guru, the drawn into the Church of Scientology, and I could go on and on. Since I came here in 87, I believe it was 87 or 88, I met a woman who actually I fell in love with and planned to marry, is into a group who uses drugs to do some programming, and I could go on and on, but I won't. The point is, what can be done about it? Who here knows any of those kind of things? What about the kids? This stuff happens in colleges. This stuff happens in school. You know, it's no, well, I call them dangerously intelligent, the people that are promoting this, that drawing people in. To draw you in with with all kinds of security, with love, with sex, with food, with anything that, you know, all the essentials, you know, everybody goes, yeah, especially when you've just broke up with somebody or had a death in the family. And, you know, I played at the Tin Cans in Scientology and all that, so what? But what can be done about it?
Well, I think, like many things, it needs to be exposed to as many people as possible. What I don't think needs to be done about it is to have Christians kidnap you, beat you back into the Bible faith and call it deprogramming. You know, I think I've met some people that are, you know, they've been part of those groups and they've come out and they're trying to help people get out of that situation. And I think always that the people that have suffered a particular type of oppression are in the best position to both define it and then build the opposition to it. So that I think the ex-members are really who it should rest on, but they shouldn't take their cues from psychiatrists or from these Christian deprogrammers or anybody else, certainly not from Jolly West, and the people that are running the current anti-cult groups, because they have their own agenda. We also need to have something that provides, outside of a manipulative context, that kind of support for people that are in trouble and in crisis. The anti-psychiatry movement that I was part of for many years, made up of ex-inmates, I wasn't one myself, but very much in support of their struggle, envisioned, you know, if the funds could have been freed from the psychiatric model, crisis centers run by ex-inmates who had had similar crises and who could bargain with people that came in a position of crisis and help them through it, you know, with certain ground rules. But it would be, you know, people that had had that experience, just as women or black people can best define and oppose their oppression.
Do you know Stephen Hassan or any of those people from the Cult Awareness Network?
That name seems to ring a bell. Do you know what group he was in?
Cult Awareness. Oh, he was one of the movies.
Yeah, I think I did meet him.
He wrote a big, thick book called Combating Cult Awareness. I talked to several people on the mainland during this whole thing.
Is he with CAN currently, or?
As he was about 3 years ago, I don't know, but he wrote that big book.
I think I did meet him at a conference where I spoke about Jonestown. But of course, I wasn't well received because the message about Jonestown was very different than their message was, get back with the Christianity, get back with the family, be what you were. Well, these people break from their families for a reason. Sometimes there's abuse, there's alienation, there's crises, there's different things, you know, and it's not just a matter of come home to daddy and fit back into the role. I mean, people are disenfranchised out there because something's happened. And the family isn't working, and that support falls off, and these people become fair game for the military recruiters and the cult recruiters and get used. But if there was a non-manipulative alternative out there, you know, for people, a place that they could turn that was really a crisis center that wasn't playing the game, you know, I think it could do it. But the only people that can do that, I think, are people who have had that experience themselves and don't have an agenda. And it's hard to find people without agendas in a society that trains you from very young to have very personal and obnoxious agendas for maintaining your privilege, class privilege, your race and sex privilege and everything else.
So what's the agenda here tonight with all of us, just to hear about it, or is there something that can be?
Well, I think Richard was mentioned earlier, I don't know if you were here in the introduction, that he was hoping that some people, yeah, there's certainly enough people in this room to make a difference well beyond this island if they wanted to work together. And I think you can both do further study. I don't think everybody has to do the homework that I do, that's the whole thing. I think people have to define what's wrong where they are and start to gather together with people that realize that and work for that, whether it's in their organization, their church, their home, you know, the business or the broader community. But the primary thing, I think, is to establish democracy. Another thing I think would be important, and you could just do it as a kind of a model, even though it had no legal power, is get all the addresses of people on the island, residential addresses of actual people living here, and sometime before April 15th, send them out a mailing. And the mailing would have a brochure with a pie showing them how their taxes are spent. It could be federal, local, both. Just how they're currently being spent. And then put in a three-part carbon form with a blank pot so they could fill in how they want their taxes spent. And stick one in with their federal or local tax. I don't have any legal thing, but just this is my way I want my taxes spent when I pay them. and then stick one in to an envelope to go back to the group that issues it, put in a return envelope, and then keep one in the drawer. And the group organizing the mailing then can collect these and draw up a pie that's really representative or democratized version of how people want their taxes spent locally or federally. And then you can call on the so-called representative who's actually voting to spend your taxes and put his pie up there next to it, or her pie, and then ask them to come out and explain who it is that they're representing. Okay? And really, I mean, you're going to catch them because they're going to come out. I did this with the student fee at my school, and these idiots came out and said, well, we couldn't just let students spend their own money. They don't know how to spend their money. You know, and the neocolonialism, their attitude would just be right on the surface. Like, we can't do it that way. But you would have planted a seed as well among anyone that pays taxes. But, you know, why aren't I in control of how they're being spent? Why do I have to rely on these people that aren't representing me? Because they don't. I mean, I sat out on the steps of the Capitol with the Veterans Fast for Life, right on the concrete steps. I used to say this is where the abstract becomes concrete. And, you know, they pull up these senators and representatives pull up in these four-door limousines. They get out in these $500 suits. You know, they didn't look like anybody I'd know or want to know, much less represent me. And they'd walk in to do their business. And a friend of mine said, well, you know, they have to wear a suit. It's a formal occasion. I said, yeah, it's our funeral. It's a formal occasion they're presiding over. But, you know, they don't, and they can't possibly represent us. So why keep going? You know, I call it the evil of two lessers. That's what the voting process is. It's not the other way around. You con yourself lesser two evils. It's the evil of two lessers, and they can't possibly do in the complex of society as we have. And we have to decentralize the society. All these decisions can't just be made at the top. We have to have much smaller communities that know what's going on, you know. And we're totally alienated. We have police that are hired that don't know any of us. They come in a situation they know nothing about, draw their guns and their batons, you know. Courts that don't, I mean, the whole system is just totally to disenfranchise us and separate us from ourselves, and also to make it so we can't trust each other, you know, and then we can turn our backs to it and try to preserve our privilege, or we can realize that there isn't any privilege left worth preserving, and we ought to go about having a human community.
May I ask about H. Ross Perot, the entire scenario? What in the world was really...
Well, Perot was used as a splitter, I think. Basically, it was Reagan's revenge on Bush, the way I saw it. You know, the splitter to make sure that Bush couldn't come back in. Perot is a reactionary. He's not an outsider or an individual as he claims to be. He was very familiar with both the Reagan and Bush White Houses. He had an insider's track. He went in and out. His political career really started when he got hold of an enormous amount of government contracting to build his computer firms. And that's basically, they siphoned off millions of dollars to him as part of a scam because of who he knew. And then once he became this self-made millionaire, you know, right around his house and his greatness, then he financed Nixon's war chest. It was a Vietnam fund similar to financing the Contras by Oliver North. After the Congress said no more war, Nixon built up an independent war chest from these millionaires. So he was paying for an independent Vietnam War, which he'd really like to go back and finish. I mean, his whole thing, you hear him talk about Vietnam, you know, we were just tricked by the government into losing, we ought to go back there and smash them Vietnamese into, you know, and, you know, it's he's really racist and reactionary at a very core level. He doesn't care about other people, but he was also the one used to promote this mythology that there are remaining POWs in Vietnam being held in prisons in Vietnam, and the government won't let anybody know about it. To me, it's like Damskin, the UFO nonsense. They come up with a government lie, and then they tell you the government's covering up the lie, so you'll believe the lie. Because if they told you the government told the lie, you know it was a lie. So now it's so bad that they have to tell you the government's covering up the lie that they're telling you, so you think maybe it's true. And there's a good book out called Myth Making in America, MIA. But this whole POW MIA scam was started by Perot and by the military intelligence so that we wouldn't normalize relations with Vietnam and we wouldn't pay them any reparations on the basis that they were holding our MIAs and POWs. The number of MIAs was the least for any war, it was like 4%. And most of the guys were medevaced out. There were a few that were blown up in the jungle or lost. I worked with the veterans coming back from Vietnam for all those years, and they told me over those years that upwards of a division went absent. Now, some of them just took families in Vietnam and they lived in country. Some of them joined the other side. Some of them went off into Laos or Cambodia. A certain percentage of MIAs and POWs are actually cover operations. One of the best covers for an intelligence operation is to say that you're dead. Then nobody's looking for you while you do what they want you to. And they had, remember, a 10-year war in Laos without anybody knowing about it. If you think that people say, like, how can they have a conspiracy? They can't keep a secret in this country. 10 years of a bombing war in Laos with people dying there and the medical supplies and everything else and the troops and tanks and planes being moved in, and not one word in the U.S. press. A 10-year war that we knew nothing about until the end of the war. So believe me, they can keep a secret. They know what a secret is, and they know how to keep it, and they know how to recruit the people that'll keep it, and they'll kill them if they don't. A real secret. That's why it's funny, you know, people talk about covert operations. We don't even know what a covert operation is. Because by definition, we know about it, it wasn't a covert operation. You see, I mean, the really covert operations, nobody's talking about. Well, I talk about a few of them, but I'm a conspiracy nut. So, you know, but I mean, you can get at them. In fact, the Reagan years, they came up with a special classification for people who could look at the little pieces of the puzzle and come up with a whole mosaic. And they actually made a blacklist of these people, and they're not allowed to see even released government documents in some areas, because by looking at stuff that's otherwise public, they might figure out what's going on. This is the Office of Secret Information, and that's the office that's going to control the release of the Kennedy files. That's the office that's in the law to come in, this one that blocked everybody out. But Perot supported this lie. The first people that came down there are supposedly veterans. None of them were Vietnam veterans down at the wall. They've been given their Vietnam uniforms in mint condition. They weren't used by Fort Hollabird Army Intelligence. One was a Vietnamese, some were Korean War vets, and they've got the most reactionary vets. I mean, these guys want to go back in and do some more killing, pumping this lie. But Perot was a major supporter of that. He's the one that financed the Rambo missions, you know, where they took this guy Bo Greitz and sent him in to look for the POWs. He and William Shatner were the two major financers for that.
But what I'm wondering is, who is Clinton then? I mean, whose side is he on?
Well, not on our side, certainly. Clinton comes from a British royalty family himself. I mean, you know, nobody, understand, if you had enough money, you'd bet every horse in the race, okay? And they don't let anybody run for president that they have, some segment hasn't already okayed. Usually the presidency is a split ticket between major factions in the class. Like, you'll have a southern rim candidate from the military-industrial complex, and then you'll have a liberal from the eastern establishment, or so-called. I mean, when push comes to shove, their true colors will show, but at least that's the idea. I saw a great parade in Massachusetts one time with a float that had an elephant and a donkey and a bed. And the bedsteads were big blocks that said ITT and mobile and everything. And they're cavorting in the bed, and as they go by, the cans are streaming out the back. And the back sign says, still married. So, I mean, it's not like they're giving you two real choices there. In fact, Clinton had stuff going on in Arkansas through this J. Stevens financial empire that tied into BCCI and the Bush money. You know, the guy that he appointed Secretary of the Treasury, Mr. Benson, was an old Bush campaigner, and actually one of the people that helped kill Kennedy. You see, so they bring, how can you have Clinton as a liberal and he has Gergen as his press secretary? And this guy that said he wanted to be in the Bohemian Club, where the Kissinger and the boys go out and take their clothes off in the woods, and, you know, it's a special club for the rich, but he gave it up for the president job, you know, he won't go out there and really tell us who he is. So you have this situation where they're clamoring for control, and one will get sort of near the top, and when they get near martial law, or think they are, then they really start fighting, they knock each other off, and that's part of what was happening with Bush and Reagan. You know, the Bush engineered the Reagan shooting in order to put himself in this crisis management control, but as they get closer to thinking they're going to have absolute control, they're like rats on a sinking ship, they all jump, you know, at each other, you know, they have no loyalty, they don't understand human trust, they only understand manipulation, and so they start fighting each other. But Clinton comes from, you know, he has bad money, he has ties to, you know, to bad finances, and he may be well-intentioned on his own level. I mean, you know, he may think of himself as some sort of a do-gooder, you know, that's had to cut some corners now and then, you know, to relate to the wrong people to get where he is. But now he's where he is, and now he realizes, as everyone does when they get there, that doesn't mean crap to be the president. It's a step down, in fact, for the real rulers of the country. But he gets to be up there and run the White House and show his face. But whenever he goes against them now, you see, I mean, they surround him, they slam him in the media, and he backs off. He won't do anything. He promises, oh, he backs off on every promise that he had, because he has to. Well, he had to during the campaign so that we would at least think there's an alternative there. I mean, you know, and he can't just say exactly the same thing as Bush, then we would have elected Perot. You know, if we elect Perot, then we really got the little fascist on his white horse, you know, coming into the White House to save us all. Is it simplistic? Just pick up the hand and look under there and see what's wrong. You know, what's wrong in part is Ross Perot, is that people are looking for the solution of this, you know, dodo who comes in and, you know, tries to make humor to tell us he's intelligent. I mean, the guy is a schmuck. I mean, you know, it's, well, all of them are. I mean, you know, in the end, none of them you'd want to have dinner with or anything. But, yeah. Clinton represents basically Rockefeller-related and Eastern establishment money more than Bush did, although Bush kind of crosses over. But, you know, in any other country, if the head of the intelligence agency became the president, you'd know what it meant. But here it's like, yeah, well, you know, Bush, a good old guy, they brought him in there. He didn't have any CIA experience, but they made him the head so that he could sort of calm things down and negotiate and problem solver. I mean, this guy's intelligence background goes all the way back into the time that he graduated, you know, from school and is recruited in from Yale, from Skull and Bones. That's the class where Buckley was brought into the CIA. I mean, it's not a secret where these guys come from, and they get CIA money, and they do their dirty work, and he's part of the Bay of Pigs, part of the Kennedy assassination. You know, you don't get there without doing something. So Clinton does something for somebody. You know, he represents somebody, and, you know, just like Bush couldn't get in without bringing in that dodo quail. But Quayle was the concession to the people that are even further to the right than Bush. Because Quayle grows up on Carl McIntyre tapes, you know, and his wife's with the fundamentalist religions, you know. And they asked him, do you remember, they asked him what would he do, the first press conference, what would he do if something happened to Bush? And it took, he had like, he kept saying, oh, I don't know, and it took about four times. And finally said, well, I guess I'd pray. And some guy in the back said, yeah, us too. you know, but I'm just, it's not that these guys don't have anything, because he was put in as part of a strategy. All the people in Congress who tried to expose the CIA, like Jacob Javits and Frank Church and the people who did the reports in the 70s, all that drug money that they had coming out of Southeast Asia was put into, and this is part of Condrogate that never was pursued, but it was there that Oliver North was financing elections with the Contra and drug money. And it was elections in the United States. They were pummeling money in underneath these PAC, right-wing political action control covers, to get those guys out of office and put their people in. And so that's what happened in Indiana. That's how Quayle got into office, was on that drug money. Okay, and Stephen Sims comes in out there. You know, they took over from certain people and knocked them out of government because they were asking too many questions about what's happening. And then he represents a certain class. Bush has interest in Indiana with the big drug cartel there, Lilly. He was on the board of Lilly. That's big money out there. And I don't know. I mean, it's just that we've got to stop focusing that somebody's going to ride up there on a white horse and save us. We're the only people that can save us. And we've got to take responsibility. They're not as formidable as they seem to me. You know, people say, like, God, how do you do this work? Aren't you afraid all the time? Or don't you think they're going to kill you? Or some people even say, you know, why aren't you dead? You know, and the only answer I have for that is they leave me alive to discredit me. But, you know, you can't live that way. I mean, you can't live in fear of things. You have to understand what they are. But to me, a fearful world would be one where you couldn't understand what was happening. You know, you're the little kid in the room in the dark and you can't see anything, and you hear these sounds or like a, you know. Well, I just said, get out of the dark, you know. Establish a national campaign to abolish paranoia and elevate it to a level of realistic and understandable fear. I don't have a word for that, because there's no word in the English language for a realistic and understandable fear. Something you ought to be afraid of, they don't have a word for that. They just tell you that if you're afraid of it, you're paranoid. You know.
Well, have you ever been investigated by the IRS?
I'm audited, you know, chased after by them for funds that I supposedly not paying.
Are you, like, harassed?
Well, I guess if they go after your bank accounts and ask you for money, then, you know, $1,000 a year, that's harassment to me. But, you know, I assume I've been investigated by most of the agencies. I know FBI did. I know that this Security and Intelligence Board that they had back in the 60s did. I know that Air Force and other military intelligence did, probably because of my mother's position in the Pentagon. And I was an anti-war protester from 64 on, so I'm sure they took a look just to make sure she wasn't giving me secrets or something. But, I, you know, my attitude is tap my phone, please, because maybe they'll learn something. You know, these agents are just little putzes. I mean, I'm putting their children through school, but I mean, they're all on need to know. Their bosses won't tell them what's going on, so I'm the only vertical information flow they've got. You know, and then they say, geez, is that why I was in Dallas on the 22nd? You know, it finally comes together for them. So, you know, I don't mind being looked at. I mean, you know, I wish they'd look at themselves a little more, but I mean, you know, it's people make a salary off it. I wish I had a salary for looking at me. I'd
you,
do a good
you,
job.
You also worked for a fair to President Bush because...
I hope not.
The fact is that while he ran the CIA, he couldn't remember whether he was or was not in the loop, so none of it counted anyway.
Well, he's one of the four people who can't remember that he was in Dallas on the 22nd.
That's true.
Richard Nixon and Richard Helms. And George Bush has a fleeting memory back and forth, you know. And, you know, there's just a few people can't recall what they did that day.
Can you give us some examples of what subliminal messages are coming through our TV today, and through what are they coming through certain programs, newscasts, or commercials?
Well, I think all the programming is essentially political in nature on television. And if you haven't read them yet, you should read Jerry Mander's two books, Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television, and his newer one, In the Absence of the Sacred. But you know, most of the things on TV are either a kind of humor in the guise of drawing us together that separates us. You know, this kind of banal level of lowest common denominator racial and sexual humor, or they're cop shows. Outer space cop shows, underwater cop shows, cops on the beach show, you know. And basically what they show is the crime at the start, so you know who the criminal is, and then the cops do whatever they want to get the criminal, even if they have to break the law, because you know he's the criminal, so it doesn't really matter that they broke the law again, because he's the bad guy. So then you learn to forget that people have constitutional rights, because the cops know that they're the criminals. Well, it wouldn't be chasing you if you weren't a criminal. You wouldn't be in court unless you committed a crime. You wouldn't be in prison unless you did something wrong, right?
So that's
the liminal level. I'm just saying, on the start level, it's a limited view. But I had articles like in Science magazine, Scientific American, from back in the 60s, and they said that they were broadcasting out of the satellite subliminal messages all over the world, every television set. And they asked the scientists, well, what are these about? And he said, oh, you know, educational information and health concerns. And even the interviewer said, well, couldn't these be used for political purposes? He said, oh, sure, of course. So, well, I mean, yeah, the messages are the ones probably that, did you see that film, They? I guess what it's called, it's John Carpenter's film about an alien invasion in the U.S. and the aliens all make themselves look normal, but they develop these special glasses and you put them on, you can see the aliens have this distorted form. But also, when you look at a billboard or any of the magazines, they don't say like Time and Newsweek, they say buy and, you know, propagate, obey orders, you know, and so the subliminal message is there underneath, you know. And of course, they have to go after the radical glasses cult and smash them before they see anything, but it's a great metaphor. And Muzak was developed. As I've got the early Muzak albums on the back of the whole explanation about how psychiatrists developed Muzak. And it was for certain purposes to calm people down. When I lived in Dayton, Ohio, I went out in the middle of a snowstorm one time, there was nobody in the street, and they were playing Muzak, blaring it on horns, like off of the top of the buildings downtown. They had this whole Muzak thing going on, you know. And then they admitted that they were like putting in the music these buy things, like, you know, buy something or go, you want, you know, like sublimating it underneath. So, I mean, I think it's kind of crude on that level, but I think they also might be doing what I'm suggesting. It's like setting out certain scenarios, like the UFO abduction scenario, as an imagery, and see who picks it up. You know, or probably terrorist, frightening kind of scenarios that you pick up and kind of keep underneath. But, you know, my main message to people is, you know, some people say they hear me talk and they go home 3 days and they don't come out in their room. I hope not. I mean, my main message really is the opposite, because I think what you need to do is, like, calm down. Calm down. Most of the things you're being told to be afraid of are government creations. And it's not that, you know, if you're in that building at that time, you get blown up, but there is no Islamic terrorist network about to blow you up. I mean, they had a thing on, when I was here, they were saying not only should foreign travel plans, you know, be careful, but also be careful about traveling in the United States. Well, what are you supposed to do to be careful? Except stay home. I mean, you know, that's the only thing you do to be careful. You can't, let me check every bag going on the plane. You know? What can you do to be careful? It's just nonsense. You know, it's like travel advisory, stay at home, shut the window so you won't smell it, and turn on the TV so you won't hear it. You know? And don't look out, things will be better soon. You know, and if you look out, there's a UFO projected in the clouds, you shut the blind. You know, or there's a terrorist at the door, Abu Nidal. I call him Abu Iman. Because it came out that the guy that was giving him all of his weapons was financially connected to North. So North tells us he's got a security fence around his house to protect him and his family from the terrorist Abu Nidal. He would have had Abu Nidal over for dinner. The fence is up there for us. If we figure out what North is up to, he's got something to have a fence for. See, he's not afraid of Abu Nidal. He is Abu Nidal. They all are. They're the ones that play the game out in order to make us afraid. So I just say, you know, calm down. Be afraid of what you should be afraid of. Stop listening to them and start demanding that you have control over your own life. And respect other people's rights to control their own lives. And to do that, you have to give up some of your privilege, what little there is left in this society. And you have to look at yourself. And you have to deal with it to the extent to which you perpetuate racism, you're a racist. You perpetuate sexism, you're a sexist. The class divisions that you perpetuate by who you are and what you do. And it doesn't make you, you know, Satan on earth, but it's something you got to be conscious of and try to change. So, I mean, the big thing in the 60s and 70s was to say, I'm not a racist, I'm not a sexist, not me. Nope. I mean, they took a poll in Baltimore in the 60s, and 100% of the people polled said their neighbors were racist, but they weren't. I mean, that's it. It's like, it's worse to be called a racist or admit that you're a racist than it is to be a racist. You see, the only fault is, like, well, I'm no racist. So everybody in my college, I'm not a racist. I would say, well, I'm a racist. I was raised in a racist culture. I was inculcated with racism from the time I was very young. I lived in all-white neighborhoods. The first black person I came within 10 feet of outside of somebody working in a store or cleaning or something, you know, this class level difference was until I was in college. You know, I was raised in that culture. I was raised with sexist attitudes and all of that. And what I say about it is, I want to be conscious of my own racism. I want to be conscious of my sexism. But if I just deny it, I'm not getting anywhere. So we have to take a look at ourselves and to what extent we're buying into this system. And we have to pull that needle out of our own. We have to stop depending on them. We have to stop making them the point and find a different way to live. And there are a lot of different ways to live. There are a lot of different ways to survive. It may not seem as easy for a little while, but believe me, it's not going to get very easy soon for a lot of people anyway. You go to any major city in the United States, you can see how large the strata of people are that don't have a job, they don't have a home, they don't have a place to turn. Because they don't need us anymore. And they're making that more than evident. They don't need us. They don't need our labor. They don't need us to grow their food. They would like a situation, the Rand Corporation studied, where at least half of the world population would disappear. At least half. It's probably more now that they'd like. And then they could live comfortably, the few. But the reality is that there's enough arable land in every nation in the world to feed more than adequately feed the people that live in that nation. Even in so-called overpopulated nations like India and China, if the arable land was used efficiently to grow food for consumption of the people who lived there, they would not be starving and they would survive. Now that's the ground level reality. But the other thing is an economic system that funnels that arable land into the hands of a select few that make a profit by growing not food but cash crop on that land and then exporting the little food that they do grow into an international market so that we can be, in the United States, 6% of the world population consuming 60% of its production. 60% or better of the energy pie. Under 2% of the people in the United States own 95% of the stocks, over 90% of the land mass. Private ownership concentrated in about 1.5% of the population. Now that's fascism. That is fascism. Because at that point, with industrial development, they don't need labor. And you are an expendable piece of dirt. Your existence means nothing to them. Now it means something to me, and it should mean something to you, and we should mean something to each other. And that's the lie that I think we have to confront first, is that we can't rely on this system for survival. It's not going to let us survive. We're expendable. We're gone. We're done. That game's over. To me, that's not a reason to be afraid. It's a reason to rise up and take control.
You mentioned bad money. Is it true that every red cent that we earn or spend is a blood money, and that it supports the people that have the bad money?
Well, the money is devalued and inherently inflationary. Even when it was on a gold and silver standard, it's still inherently inflationary because those are scarce items. Monies have to be issued in order to be equitable. They have to be issued either on a basket of commodities so that they don't have such a fluctuation. Like you can take 30 basic commodities, gold, wheat, copper, on the world market, and you can track their fluctuations in terms of value, and you can base a currency on that. This was done in an experiment in Exeter, New Jersey, by Ralph Rizzotti, an economist who predicted the Depression. He called them constants, and in fact they were. They not only remained constant in value, they increased in value while the dollar went down. So the people in the five-year experiment, the banks and the local stores recognized the currency, and they made money. There were communities, and they either have to base it on that or you have to base it on real production. Okay, so that basically when the crop comes in the door, you get a king's stick for that amount of crops. I mean, you know, it's based on the GNP. If you base it on a metallic or bimetallic standard, or you base it now on the whim of the people issuing it, you've got an inherently inflationary situation. You've also got a situation that inflates whenever you take anything out of the economic flow of production and consumption that doesn't put a product back into that flow. And three primary examples of that, protected by state force for a very long time, are rental on lands. Once lands could be privately owned from the 13th century on, when the nobles could hire enough thugs to protect the land, they could have title to the land, and they could charge rent on the land. They didn't put any crops in, they took crops out. That inflates the monetary value no matter what it is, because they're getting money with no service and no production. The second is usury, or interest on loans beyond bookkeeping. Okay, and this is considered a crime in the Muslim nations, usury. And it's taking money off and not putting anything back into the flow. Okay? And a third is taxation by the government that gives no product back for the taxation, okay? Or buys a product like arms that's you know, expendable in one use.
So it's all blood money.
Well, then once it inflates, it also concentrates. Certainly it's all, I mean, Proudhon, the French anarchist, said many, many years ago in the 18th century that property is theft. Because the concentration of property in the human community by that point was really based on long periods of theft prior to the Industrial Revolution. Thieves, you know, sometimes in the crown of kings, but thieves concentrated wealth by thievery and by force. And so, you know, all that money is, doesn't mean that everybody working for a dollar is ill-earning the dollar, but you have an inflated dollar. It's not representative of the economy, and it's not going to get better, it's only going to get worse. As the funds increase in terms of the concentration of the wealth, then the companies, corporations, which they give individual status, or the rich families invest abroad for cheap labor or cheap raw materials there for their production. When those investments become threatened by national or revolutionary interests, then the rich call on the government, which they also own, to send troops. And who do you think sells the guns and the tanks to the troops? The same rich families and companies that are making the buck in the first place. And then they send the youth of the country out to do the defending. So it's a situation that eventually ends in war and bloodshed, genocide worldwide, in order to protect these privileged classes and interests at the top. When they fight amongst each other, they orchestrate scandals.
Is there any groups in the country that is trying to go through a barter system? Or?
Yes, they're barter organizations. I'm part of a rural revivalist decentralist movement since the 30s has existed called School of Living. And Mildred Loomis was one of my mentors. Bersody worked with that. They differed. Bersody wanted nuclear family farms. She believed in that and community farming. But he also worked with the Gramdan movement, which was village cottage industry in India for survival, which helped a lot of people who were poor to survive and prosper in India. There were examples here, like during the Depression. See, the dollar fails, the stock market goes, and the dollar fails in value, and everybody pulls back their credit. Then the people that were hiring or working on credit pull off the jobs, and everybody's unemployed. This is the cycle right in the beginning of the Depression. The banks call in their loans, the lands go, and everybody's in a panic. The economy collapses. But if you think about it, the day after the stock market crashes and the Depression starts, they don't have any less raw material in the country. They don't have any less industrial capability to develop the raw material and distribute it. They don't have any less labor involved to do the job. What are they missing? Money? And money is a measure of wealth or a commodity of exchange, but within our society it has become wealth itself. And that confusion leaves people in a situation where they, withdraw credit, drawing jobs, and fight each other over a phony credit system. A lot of the credit that extends now, and it's $7 trillion out in credit in this economy. If you think the stock market crash in the 30s looked bad, when they call in $7 trillion in loans, and most people don't own things. Most people don't own their trucks, their TVs, there's a vast chronically unemployed or underemployed class. There's a lot of people living on credit, and they hit that wall at the end of World War II when the troops come home, and they're starting the whole advertising age and the beginning of the mass consumption hegemony. They're producing way more than people can buy or use, and they're paying, by that time, having crushed the labor movement, they're paying salaries so low that people can't afford the goods that they're being told they need or want by the advertising. And they set up, right then in the 50s, the layaway programs, which became the credit system. And that's basically because people don't make enough to buy the products that they create back from the owners. And so they have to extend credit. Now, credit isn't money. That's why I say one alternative would be to establish an alternate ethical credit system with each other. Because if I print money, the ATF boys, and we just saw them in Waco, are going to come down the tube. They all belong to the Treasury. Lloyd Benson was, in fact, the main runner as head of the Treasury of the Waco raid, along with Sessions of the FBI, who had figured into the cover-up on both Kennedy and Martin Luther King. And these guys were advising Reno. But you can't print money. You can't print script or cite script. The right wing have different alternatives. Or part of the right wing want to go back to gold. But you can issue credit. Credit is as American as apple pie. And at least currently, you can issue credit on a lot of bases. And there would be a way for us to interrelate with each other through a combination of barter and credit. They would try to stop it. There was a massive barter system during the Haight Asbury period in San Francisco. And they had telephone lines. People called in with goods or services they wanted to part with. And people called in with what they needed. And they hooked them up. And so they trade, babysitting or car washing for a used refrigerator or whatever. They hooked them up. And the feds actually came in and closed down the phone lines because it was starting to undermine the commercial economy. So they're afraid of it, and you'd probably have to do it in a decentralized, not a centralized way, but it could be done, you know, with computers and those things. But their money is not only blood money, it's worthless money, and it gets more worthless as they go. And they're basically just issuing it now as show, because it has no basis in even gold or silver. I mean, it's just issued when they figure economy's slowing down, a little more money out there, you know, and then you spend some more money. But eventually you'll have to carry it in a wheelbarrow. I mean, I can think back to when I was a kid, what things cost, and then what they cost today. And I take what they cost today and I divide by four to decide if I think it's a reasonable price for the thing. In other words, what a car costs is what a house costs. What a house costs is what a business building costs. I mean, it's just phenomenal how worthless the money is. But because it goes by increments, people keep saying it'll get better. You know, and it can't. I mean, there isn't anywhere, and they're predicting like hundreds of bank failures this year in the economy. Hundreds of bank failures, because they're all based on the same scam. It's all just an inflated pump. And when it goes, and when they withdraw credit, then either a lot of people are going to get very freaked out and panicked and not survive, or our responsibility, I think, is to try to think through some ethical alternatives that are there for people now. There's enough people now already in a panic. But yeah, all blood money. All money is blood money, and all property is theft.
John, my question dovetails with him. The fundamentalists seem to think that there's a fiscal conspiracy to devalue currency and replace it with a vast credit system, ultimately culminating in some type of psychological control. Do you see that happening?
I think I've just described it. I don't describe a Jewish banker conspiracy as being responsible for it, but I think, yeah, that's certainly what they've done, is hooked us on a devalued currency. I think the concentration of issuance of monies within the Federal Reserve in the 30s is a step in that direction, but I think that was a logical outgrowth of other concentrations of the wealth and the failure of the old private bank system. Banks used to be owned by families who issued the money on the basis of their family name, just like funeral homes have to have family names. And, you know, somebody had a stake in it, then it went to commercial banks and then eventually centralized into a national bank. But that's just a natural flow of centralization. You don't have to have some arcane conspiracy to understand why you'd set up a national bank or why it would function in that way to further concentrate the wealth. It just does, that's what it's for. But I don't, you know, in other words, I don't see that as the stepping point. I see the stepping point much earlier with the ways in which wealth was allowed to concentrate legally and have the power of the state behind issuance of monies and charging on loans. As long as those are state protected, you can't get beyond them, I don't think. And then the third is title to lands. Because land is the central question. Land and money are central to freeing people up. But what I'm saying is that you can do it yourself. There were communities in the Depression. Everybody else was going broke. These small communities in the South issued the banks, took in greenbacks, knowing that they were useless, and issued local scrip. And the banks and the community and the stores recognized the local scrip, and they issued it on an equitable trade basis. Give me your dollar and I'll give you this piece of scrip. I'll recognize the scrip in your account. You can spend the scrip at the store. Then they turned local production inward so that the first production of food and clothing and whatever was done for local need. And then if there was surplus, the banks instituted agencies to sell that abroad for the worthless dollars and exchange externally with the worthless dollars while having local scrip issued on eventually on a production basis. And these communities not only survived the Depression, they thrived during the Depression. They used their local resources rationally. The monies by the end of the Depression that they had taken as local scrip were worth almost 10 times what they had originally exchanged them for in dollars, which again shows you the worthlessness, you know, of the dollar. I remember this example in the paper. I couldn't believe they put it in there, and it was the exact opposite of the truth. It was to make you think about, oh, it was a woman who had bought a house with her husband for $15,000 or $20,000 in the 1940s. And now she was selling that house for for $350,000. So they're interviewing her, and they, did you ever think when you were buying this $15,000 house that you'd sell it someday for $350,000? Oh no, I'm fabulously rich. You know, I have $350,000. And they said, well, what are you going to do now, buy another house? She says, oh, I just spent the money and I bought a little condo. It's just big enough for me. Well, they had a house for $15,000. Now they can only get a little skinny condo for $350,000, and they think they're rich. You get the point? The money isn't worth anything. But you can con yourself into thinking it is.
I don't have any first-hand UFO experience, and I don't really care.
Why?
Well, I'm curious. I don't really care, you know, terrestrial, extraterrestrial. But what I got from Stryver and what I got from other intelligent writers going back to Carl Jung was that these experiences are like an experience with mystery and a unique opportunity. You can either get freaked out, or it's an opportunity for self-realization, for self-examination. Like, Stryver has that one racist in the first book. He has an experience where he realizes, you know, I am a racist too. And he even titles one book Transformation. I don't understand how this could be used for, you know, control, people discovering themselves.
I think the control comes when you go to Stryver and then you are channeled into by him into one of the contactee cults. And he refers you to other people who've had this experience. Those cults, in turn, are channeled through to the Space Brothers and everything, and their information is run by military intelligence. Let me give you one. I gave you the example earlier, the UFO group out in the desert with Singlau, and they see the saucer. Another one, similarly, in the New Age group, a shamanistic organization, is run by this guy named Harley Swiftdeer. Now, that's not his real name. He's an Army intelligence agent from Korea, in the Korean War. He has all these white people in the group take native names. So it's like Marjorie Morningbird, you know, and they all take these names that they think sound like native names. And then, I mean, not only that deception, but they have this vision quest you go through. And when you go through it, they give you this drug, ecstasy, or XTC, they call it ecstasy. And while you're on the drug, then they guide you through this experience, and you see the Space Brothers come to you in this experience. So I was dealing with a researcher who had seen a connection between the mind control victims' descriptions of consciousness and the UFO abductees, the missing time, a number of other elements, and began to suspect that this stuff was part of mind control operations. This woman had gotten out of this group, gone through the ecstasy thing, believed in it for a while, gotten out of it. She was a little freaked out at the time because when the Space Brothers came, among the things they did is they gave her a gun. It was in a plastic bag, and they handed her this gun. She didn't like guns. And they told her that she better get used to carrying a gun around and learn how to use a gun because they might have a big job for her someday and she'd have to use it. Then they told her, and these subsequent things with the Space Brothers come, they told her they wanted her to follow John Lennon around and try to shake his hand. And subsequently, in one of the meetings of the group that she was at, another woman who used the name Arlene Skywalker, who was her guide to these beings, told her that she had also been the guide for Mark David Chapman, the guy that actually shot John Lennon. Now see, this is what I think that this can be used as a programming matrix, just like Satanism or the black dog that talks to Son of Sam. You're really a government assassin. And then also later, when she remembered the event years after getting out of this and getting away from it, the human faces reappeared. The UFO beings went away with the little slit eyes and human faces appeared giving her the gun. Okay, so I think that they were using the drug in some kind of disorientation, maybe a mask, whatever, to create an illusion that she was talking to people from outer space, but in fact, they were programming her. And if she had killed Lennon, she would say, the Space Brothers told me to do it, or the devil told me to do it. So to me, even if they're not doing it for that purpose, it's a perfect excuse. Can you get something out of the experience? Probably. Anybody can develop something positive. I mean, I never used any drugs. I never used acid. I never smoked marijuana. I don't drink liquor. I never used any drug because I didn't want to change my flow of consciousness and the history of my consciousness. I didn't want to give that up because I didn't want to lose something in the process. But I knew people, and especially in the 60s when the acid was relatively pure before it got to strychnine and all the government drugs then, the old Owsley acid, that, and people would smoke marijuana then before the Paraquat was sprayed on it and all the drugs became chemical toxins, that I thought, you know, develop something from that experience. I mean, I thought it opened them up a little bit. I found that when I was around people who were stoned, I had an easier time relating to them than people that weren't stoned for the most part. It was sort of like they had my sense of humor and they caught up with me a little bit and had a better time with them. And so, you know, but I never got stoned. I mean, I never did it. But so, on the other hand, I knew of people that took acid and had, you know, horribly bad experiences with it. So I think it's like anything else. And it might be, in some cases, a mystical or trans-dimensional experience of some kind, or it might even be an extraterrestrial experience. All I'm saying is that there is another thing going on. There's another level of manipulation going on. And when somebody like Strieber, who's written these books on black magic and now writes this book backing up this Majestic 12 stuff, which I know Majestic 12 is supposed to be this group of 12 people in the government that are working for the aliens, and they have these documents. The documents are fake. They aren't legitimate intelligence documents. I've showed them. Fletcher Prouty's seen them. He's the guy that was portrayed as Mr. X in the JFK film, and a longtime intelligence operative, and he knows that they're not real documents. But these are put forward, and Strieber backs this stuff up. And Strieber has this book saying, I had this experience, and here's my address. And if you had this experience, write to me. I would not write to that guy. I would not let that guy know that I had that experience. Because to me, it's just classic sort of information gathering in a vacuum cleaner. And they say, yeah, we got you. You think you were abducted by a UFO. So, you know, you got the message. And now we'll tell you what it meant. And we'll put you in touch with the UFO or whatever. I just don't trust the approach. I think, you know, any experience can be positive. My experience with a flying saucer in the 1950s when I was 5 years old was probably the most positive thing that happened to me in terms of UFOs, because I saw the human pilot. I didn't understand it when I was five. I understand it now I'm 45, but that human pilot in there was an Army operative, probably out of Holabird or wherever they were flying them from, flying the damn thing. But I mean, I knew it was a human being. It didn't look like all the pictures that they had in the flying saucer magazines, these little green guys. It looked like a human being. So, you know, I understood it later. So I'm not, even if you, but if you, what I'm saying is if you connect with one of these phony UFO experiences, you're in trouble. And you're not going to have a very positive thing out of it. And they are manipulating it. And Jacques Vallée, I think if you haven't read him yet, read his books, especially the recent ones, Revelations and Messengers of Deception, these other ones, because that's a real scientist that's looking at this stuff, and he doesn't know what it is yet. He thinks it might be dimensional, but he also knows it's being manipulated.
Well, but in the scientific community, I mean, serious scientists completely dispute the fact that there could be any aliens here, just because of the way that the universe is laid out in the first place. Enormous distances between, it's just absolutely impossible for it. I don't know of any really serious scientists who say that this is plausible at all. So I don't understand where all this propaganda, why it's being so easily digested by the community. What is it?
Well, part of the reason I think it's easily digested and many religions are digested is because people want a solution. They want a saucer being to come down and save the world, because they can't figure out how to save the world, and they're afraid to take responsibility for changing things. And it's easier to believe that than to believe what you have to do and go through to really change the situation and take responsibility for your life. Leave it up to the saucer beings. They're watching. They're going to take care of it. They know better than me. And, you know, they'll save the planet. I can't. I'm just a little schmuck. I can't do anything. They told me that on TV. I can't do anything. And, you know, I can't run City Hall, and I'm powerless. So, you know, I don't think people are apathetic. I think people are trained that they have no power, no control, no ability to do anything. They're given that message over and over until they start to believe it. But they're given that message because if they did understand the power that they have, they'd be a problem. And so they're told they can't change anything, and it's useless to try to do anything. And in fact, when they do start to try to do things, the government comes in and tries to stop them or divide them or whatever. But if you're conscious, it's not hard to see that stuff when it happens, and it's not hard to get around it. You know, it takes some thinking, it takes some work, but I mean, people can work together. You know, and people can understand what the real difference is and stop fighting each other and playing out. And then if you have real human trust and real human community, that's the acid test. The agent can't get past that. The agent doesn't understand anything about that. You know, and the agent just comes in and does what they're told to do, but it can't make a difference. And that's how things, you know, move forward. I mean, the Indian government had agents, the British had agents in India, but they couldn't stop Gandhi. They couldn't stop him. They couldn't stop him with a gun because he had satyagraha, he had the truth force. You say, I don't want to get nonviolent with you now. He understood what was happening, you see. And that force of understanding is much more powerful than a gun. I had people come at me with fists and knives when I was a little kid, and I refused to fight. Most people try to beat me up, I'd start laughing. Because to me it was absurd. I mean, we all have arms, and we have fists, and we can do this, and we can swing it, and we can hit each other, and we can make each other fall down. So what? So what? That means something about you or about me? You swung, and I fell down, or I swung, and you fell down, that means something? I just would start to laugh, and then the people trying to hit me, was like, what are you laughing at? You're not supposed to be laughing, you know, you're supposed to be quaking in fear, I guess, you know. I said, I'm laughing at you, what are you doing? And it got through on a human level to a lot of people. I mean, I don't say I never got hit, I did, but, you know. It was more important to me to do that than to swing back and reinforce the programming, you know. I just didn't want it. So, you know, by the time I was supposed to register for the draft, I knew I wasn't going to pick up a gun and go kill somebody miles away. I mean, I freaked out when I was 10 years old and they had these little desks, chair and a desk together. And they said there was going to be this big bomb, the atomic bomb, I didn't know what it was, a big bomb. It was going to blow everything in, the roof might collapse, the windows might crawl in, and I was supposed to get under this little desk, you know, with this little thing over my head about that big, and crouch under this little desk with this bomb. I mean, it was my first, like, real political realization. I was with insane people. These people that I had entrusted my little 10-year-old life to were out of their goddamn minds. I mean, they were telling me there was this horrible bomb, and all they wanted me to do was get under the stupid desk. I mean, and then I found out it's a real seminal experience. I talked to all these people that grew up in the 50s and 60s, and they had different things. Some wore tags, name tags, during the drills so they could be identified after they were dead. And now, but think about what this does to the consciousness of a 10-year-old kid, even if they don't admit it to themselves or deal with it at the moment. This is very frightening. And they had other people go out in the hallway and open up the locker and stick their head in the locker and tell it to pack, you know, like an ostrich. It's not happening. There isn't a bomb out there. I have my head in the locker. I don't see it. It's not there. No. I mean, this is what you're supposed to do for an atomic bomb. And I wouldn't get under the desk. I got sent to the principal's office, you know, and years later I read about Dorothy Day. Dorothy Day, Catholic Workers Movement, a nonviolent political activist. They had whole city drills in New York where you're supposed to go down in these air raid shelters and wait for the bomb, and she wouldn't go down. She sat in Central Park and she got arrested for civil disobedience and got in the paper. And the next time they had one, 25 people got arrested. And the next time they had one, 150 people got arrested. And the next time they had 5,000 people in Central Park who wouldn't go down in the air raid shelter, and they quit doing them. That's the way you take the government off your back. You just say, I'm not playing this game anymore. This is ridiculous. Take your bomb off my back. That's what she said. You know, come and tell me, get down in a damn hole, get rid of that bomb.
Yeah. Are there any national sources of news that are not owned or controlled or manipulated by corporate America?
Yeah, people say, how could they control the news? It's a free press. You know, how could they not control the news? How could they maintain the level of control that they have and not control the news? The news is a corporate entity. The news is owned. CBS, ABC, those are corporations. They aren't benign, nonprofit, democratic societies. They're privately owned and run, or corporately owned. A study was done of the concentration, this was some years ago in the 70s, by Congress, the concentration of wealth and control over corporations. 20 corporations at that point owned all the major media in the United States. All electronic and print media, 20 corporations. Do you know that now, they just did a study at six? Six corporations. The major television networks were owned through a interlocking board of directorates by the Rockefeller family. ABC, CBS, NBC were all Rockefeller-owned and manipulated firms at the board level. So that was all Rockefeller news that you got through all those years, you know, and the trusted Walter Cronkite. Walter Cronkite came in 1967 to support the Warren Commission with Dan Rather and did a special. And he comes and stands in Dealey Plaza, and he looks up at the window where Oswald was supposed to have been with the rifle he was supposed to have shot to do all the damage he did. And he says, you know, it just doesn't seem possible. One man firing from one location could have done so much damage. Under ordinary circumstances, it just doesn't seem possible. And then he takes his glasses off and they pan the camera in so you know it's serious. He says, but these were no ordinary circumstances. He was firing at the President of the United States. Well, we know that physics then suspend themselves and bullets do what they want. He's firing at the President of the United States, for heaven's sake. Then one bullet can do all that he needed to do and even end up in Connally. Too much of it. The bullet fragments that they pulled out of Connally's wrist, separate from the ones they buried him with, the ones that they pulled out at the time weighed more than was missing from the single bullet that the Warren Commission said did the job. So you've got a bullet and a half to do the job. And then when they did, when the House Select Committee did the neutron activation, this is why we want the fragments. When they did the neutron activation, the fragments that they used that they said matched the single bullet didn't weigh the same as the fragments they had taken out years before. So it's easier to replace the fragments. I mean, the way that you kill Hitler, okay, and make it work is not to get an exact duplicate of Hitler. You get somebody who looks a little bit like him, you put him in the bunker and you burn him up, and then they go in and they check his teeth, right? Well, I got an article in Vermont Magazine written years later after this guy in the 50s. He's the leading forensic dentist in the United States, a dental pathologist into forensics. He does identification. He writes the textbooks. Study University of Pennsylvania in the 50s. Absolute expert. He's writing in this state magazine, this little article. He said he didn't want to write it until he had best evidence, and it took him 30 years to compile it. In the 50s, his roommate at the dental school in the University of Pennsylvania was Hugo Blaschke. Hugo Blaschke was Hitler's private dentist. So 56, he's rooming with Hugo Blaschke. Hugo Blaschke is mentioned in the main text. He's got a Cornelius Long, Longest Day, you know, that on World War II. He's in all the stories, and he said that Hugo Blaschke told him, and he didn't know whether to believe him at the time, but now he's done the homework and checked the records and everything else, and the Russian files are finally released. He's seen the dental stuff. Blaschke told him that they switched the dental records. As they left, they took Hitler's dental records and put the dental records of the guy that's in the bunker. Well, that's the way you do it. It's much easier than replicating the body or futzing around. You just make the records match. So those are that guy's records, and they're in Hitler's drawer, so it must be Hitler in the bunker. And the guy who verified it, the guy who wrote the book saying that Hitler was dead, was a British intelligence agent by the name of Hugh Trevor Roper. You know that name?
Yes.
He wrote the introduction to the phony book, Rush to Judgment, by government intelligence agent Mark Lane. The first bestseller on the Kennedy assassination, the guy who claimed Hitler was dead, writes the introduction, because Lane is holding the line at the discrepancies in the Warren Commission report. He's not going to tell you that the Nazis did it, and he won't tell you to this day. He blames E. Howard Hunt and a couple of Cubans in the CIA. This was a military coup d'etat by the Nazis and the fascists and the CIA and Defense Intelligence Agency. It was engineered by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They cut the communication lines in D.C. They disarmed the Strategic Air Command without any code books in the air that hour. They took over the country. And they're not going to give it back for nothing. They didn't kill Kennedy for nothing. They're still around. But they did kill Kennedy because he was going in the direction that people were pushing him. He wanted to end the war in Vietnam. He wanted to dismantle the CIA. He wanted to fight racial segregation in the South. He wanted to normalize relations with Cuba. He wanted an arms limitation talk and to stop nuclear testing. He wanted detente with the Soviet Union. He wanted to end the Cold War. And the Cold War was the whole symbiotic game on both sides. So it was too dangerous a position. He had to be stopped. He wanted to end the oil depletion allowance, $27 billion in tax write-offs in 1963, when that was real money, have financed elections in the United States, and he wanted to end it. He wanted to get rid of organized crime. You can't have organized crime and organized police in the same society unless they work together. And they did. And he wanted to go after organized crime. His brother went after Hoffa. He wanted to put Bobby in charge of the CIA to break it. He put Bobby into Mongoose, not because they wanted to kill Castro. They wanted to stop the people who were killing Castro. That's why Bobby went into Mongoose. They opposed further raids into Cuba. They smashed Alpha 66 and Omega 7. Why do you think Ferry and those guys were so furious with them? Because they wanted to kill Castro and maintain the program? No. But that's what Noam Chomsky will tell you now. That's what Howard Zinn and the left historians will tell you. It doesn't matter who killed Kennedy. That's what Alexander Coburn and the boys will tell you. He wasn't pulling out of Vietnam. He was a Cold War murdering bastard like the rest. He was just another rich scum at the top. And if you think anybody can come in and save the country as president, you're just dreaming. But you see, these guys are like somebody in a forest who's sitting on the branch of a tree that you're about to run into. And they're not allowed to mention the tree because you might not see the forest. All that they can yell is that the top is corrupt, but they can't tell you how. They can't name a name, they can't give you a history. I went to a talk by the ex-intelligence agent, Philip Agee, on CIA in the Middle East. He didn't give one name. He didn't tell you that Schwarzkopf's father worked with the overthrow of Mossadegh to put the Nazis in power, or the background of that whole family, which includes connections with Lucius Clay and the pardoning of the Nazis. These guys don't come from nowhere. Schwarzkopf, a good German name, you know. They come out of a historical framework, but he can't say any of that. In fact, he bragged at the lecture that he has to clear every word of his lectures ahead of time with the CIA. And they've never changed a single word. And the audience breaks into a rapturous applause. I yell from the back, that's because you don't say anything. You can't have an ex-intelligence agent walk and talk any more than you can have an ex-mafia agent walk and talk. Either he's so low on the totem pole it doesn't matter what he knows, and he can talk till it turns blue, he doesn't know anything anyway. So let that schmuck talk. Who's going to believe him and what does he know? If he's up high enough to know something, if he's in charge of something, then there's only two options. Well, there's three. One is that he's working for the agency as a planted critic, like Mark Lane on the Kennedy assassination. He's out there to be the critic. You know, he'll tell you everything that's in the New York Times. It's already revealed in the past 20 years, but he won't go any further, and he won't do anything else. And he goes out there to find out who's interested, and he takes your name down. And he's the official criticism, and it doesn't go too far. Like Victor Marchetti, a kept dog. See, Marchetti was challenged on his patriotism on a radio show after he wrote CIA and Cult of Intelligence, and he got so incensed, he answered by saying even after he wrote the book, the agency had approached him to do jobs and he'd done them. This is an ex-intelligence agent. Okay. And they had me on a Dayton station one time talking about domestic operations of the CIA, and the next day they had him to talk about foreign. They spent the whole day asking whether what I said was true. And he had to admit, you know, he said that they debriefed at the CIA about Clay Shaw, you know, concerned about Oswald, and all the connections that I had made. He balked because I had said that the CIA was studying ethnically oriented chemical biological weapons in the 1940s and 50s to kill certain races and not kill others. He said, they're not that bad. I called up and I said, Victor, you're 5 years out of the agency. You were never in operations, you were always in analysis. If they were that bad, you wouldn't know it. And that day, I read from the text, because that week, the story had broken in the news about the CIA in New York in the subway system with little light bulbs full of these sarracen germs. They burst in the train path to see where the wind would carry them and whether they could do biological attacks in the subway system. The Center for Disease Control was an extension of the Pentagon in the 1950s. I went back and got their original magazines. They were supposed to be set up to determine whether the Soviets were doing covert chemical and biological warfare in the United States via the jet stream or some other delivery method, and they were going to do it by tracking morbidity and mortality rates. Well, they were tracking their own experiments to see whether they were doing any good. The hell with the Soviets. They weren't afraid of the Soviets. They're way ahead of the Soviets. But see, it's like mind control. They give themselves their own excuse. They make it up so they can do their tests. So So that's one option. He's working for the agency. The other is that there are factional fights within the agency, and his faction covers his rear end while he exposes the other faction. So he's really still working for the agency, but maybe a liberal faction exposing a conservative faction and vice versa. The third is that he's an agent, he's in the know, and he comes out and he starts to talk. And we've got plenty of examples of those. The real ex-intelligence agents are dead. Stone dead. Because you don't walk and talk on an agency that does genocide, that controls countries, including this one. You think they'd spend $10 million on an election in Chile and not spend $10 billion on an election in the United States? Which one is more important? You think it all stops at the border? Well, we'll kill those other leaders, take over those countries, manipulate this, but this is the United States, democracy here. Can't touch it.
Why wouldn't they?
Hmm?
Are you saying none of those guys have any integrity at all? Their charter specifically states they will not be involved in politics in this country. Are you telling me they have no integrity at all? None of them? Not one?
Oh, there might be some that do. Put them in the less important jobs.
But all the guys on top are all scum.
Scum rises, my friend.
Who's the moral?
Physical principle. Yes, I think that the people that get to the top are corrupted. My rule of thumb, in fact, is if you've heard of anybody, they're no damn good. Because the people that are doing anything decent, you'll never hear them about them.
They would want to be at the top.
You got to tell me.
You're at the top, you got everybody else fighting you.
You got to tell me, because I can't live until I find out why Hitler wasn't in the bunker or whatever.
Because fascism was meant to survive.
So they
Nazis, criminals, Bormann, they went to South America. Some of them went to the Antarctic. For a period. They had a base in the Antarctic. In 36, they founded it, von Ribbentrop, and it was warm inner arms of the sea. And he went there and marked it off. It's in the National Geographic. And it sounds fantastic, but they had an area that was warm. And then, you know, that wasn't all iced over, and they had underground caves. And in 46, Admiral Byrd took a military expedition, not a scientific expedition, a military expedition to the Antarctic, and he saw flying saucers. And he talks about it in the New York Times, coming back, when he stops off in South America, and then he's debriefed, and shortly after that he goes out the window at the Bethesda Center. You know. But he says he saw these holes in the earth, and that's this whole hollow earth stuff. That was just the holes into the Nazi caves that they had there. And he saw the saucers, and they were causing his reconnaissance planes to crash, like the old Foo Fighters. And he came back, and he said, he's quoted in Santiago in Chile in the papers, and he says, World War III will begin in the Falkland Islands. Because Falkland was central to that section of the South Pacific, of the Arctic Oceans. It had been a British base. And he said that the Nazis have these craft that can fly at tremendous speeds, and they'll come over the pole, and we won't see them, and they can attack America. And he said, fascism isn't dead. So that's the secret. Fascism doesn't die. That's the biggest Cold War secret. Bigger than the lie about the communists, is that the fascists retrenched, regrouped, as they did at the end of World War I, they did in World War II. They went underground, they came in, they formed our CIA, they formed military intelligence here, you know, and formed the whole military industrial complex in the Southern Rim economy. And so, you know, they're really what's at the top. I mean, are these fascists and proto-fascists. They don't have any integrity, any respect for human life or anything else. You don't have to control everybody in an agency. People say, how could you control a newspaper? There's all these reporters, blah, blah, blah. All you have to have in your pocket is the owner of the newspaper, the final editor, and the assignment editor. The assignment editor sends the CIA guy to do the CIA story, and he sends the honest guy to do the unimportant story. The final editor catches the things that go through the crack, and the owner resolves the dispute. You don't have to control everybody to control a society. It doesn't have to be a conspiracy of thousands and thousands of people in on the know. In fact, the less that know, the better. That's what need to know is. But you have a few at the top, and you can compromise and corrupt the whole system. And they were doing these things, and they can get good people to do bad things because they give them an excuse. The Soviets are going to brainwash us. We don't know anything about it. You've got to help us study. And the scientist says, okay, I'm proud. I'll do a job for my country. I'll protect us. I'll protect us from nuclear attack. I'll protect us from terrorism. I'll protect us from mind control. Not understanding that they're establishing the conditions for the manipulation itself.
Well, to get back to the original question, Hitler did not die in America?
No. Neither did he. Neither did he.
Are they dead now?
Probably by now, yeah.
So they were taken to the Antarctic?
They spent a period in the Antarctic to get a base, and then they were taken up into South America. They were in different countries, but there were South American fascists that allowed Otto Skorzeny and Bormann to specifically move the money, and then these other Nazis transplanted there. A great number, thousands of them came in the United States, but not Hitler, not the top echelon. They stayed in other countries.
I don't know why would they want to kill John Lennon? I mean, I never got
because he was a tremendous voice. If he had called for a public demonstration, he would have had a million people in the street the next day. They had silenced him on drugs for a long period. I think myself that his wife was involved in that. Wittingly or not, I think she got him onto the heroin. She's no little somebody in the closet herself. Her father was the richest Japanese banker all through World War II. The top Axis money flowed through her father, and her father, at times when other Japanese were put in concentration camps, was allowed free access between Japan and the United States throughout the war. That's Ono, that's the family. She's still one of the richest people in the world. And, you know, they credit her in many of the biographies for breaking up the Beatles, which was a political force. These groups at Big Sur and the counterculture were political music. They were creating a whole alternate consciousness, and many of them died very violently, supposedly on drug overdoses. But these people didn't have to get street drugs cut with strychnine and battery acid. When you have their kind of money, you can get pure drugs, and you cannot physically overdose on pure heroin or pure cocaine. I got that from Reader's Digest, listed in illicit drugs, an extensive study. They took people who had never done any drugs and pumped them with more than a long-term heroin addict takes in a day, and they don't OD when it's pure stuff, which means that what they're ODing on, they say in DC about every 6 months, they say, well, a batch of pure heroin came into town and 12 addicts died. I said, you know, well, first of all, the economy is impossible. Who would make pure heroin when you're making a profit by cutting it? You're not going to let a bad, oops, forgot the talcum. But the pure heroin wouldn't kill them. See, it's the contaminants in it that does the overdose. You'd have to take over two grams of cocaine sniffed to even get to the point of going unconscious, according to these articles. Pure cocaine. Now, what you're sniffing from the street is something else. But I was at a conference where these forensic scientists, and they didn't know, they were looking at me, most of them cops. I was at the back, and they had a display of these two pewter jars, or little dishes, petri dishes you call them, like use them in chemistry, and they had a little line of green leaves, and it was marijuana. And this guy had a thing that looked like a microphone with a square head, and it went back on a telephone cord to a little box with a light on it, and he passed it over the first plate, and a little bell would ring, 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 as he passed it over, and a light would light up. And all the cops were like, what's that? He says, gentlemen, this machine can detect any amount of marijuana. Pocket litter, a little bit in a rug, anything left, this can pick it up. Ring, 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 and he's getting the reaction. Then he takes it over to the other dish, and it goes, bzz, 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 and the light lights up. And they look the same, and the cops are all like, takes it back over to it. Ring, 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 bzz, bzz, bzz. He says, gentlemen, this machine can also distinguish between domestic type, ring, 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 and CIA type. Bzz, bzz, bzz. I said, domestic type and CIA type, and you can put a thing over it. It's got to be radiation or chemical, right? I mean, what does that mean? And the cops all went, uh-huh. They know the difference. And I talked to people who smoke marijuana and got stoned pleasantly. I talked to other people who had very bad experiences with marijuana. So what are they giving you? They're giving you their drugs. They control the market. Independent dealers in Dayton, Ohio, once the Cleveland Syndicate got in there by the mid-60s, either dealt their drugs at their prices, left town, quit dealing, or they had three bullet holes right here. And that took about a month before there were no independent labs, no independent dealers. It was mafia CIA drugs all the way, and you dealt what they wanted or you didn't deal. Okay? And so that idea of like drugs is sort of the counterculture, you know, rebellion against the state. They were drugging you, and they were making the profit off of it. They make over $1 million a day on heroin alone, just on heroin, in Harlem alone. That's one community, one drug, over $1 million. Raw opium to street level heroin goes up at least 10 times in value. 1,000% increase in value, at least, sometimes 30 times. That means that it was worth their trouble with the Mao tribes in Southeast Asia who grew the opium poppies to drop in gold in exchange for raw opium, because gold is worth less. You'll make more money on the opium than you will on the gold, so that was the exchange. Gold bars for raw opium, break it down in the labs, morphine, heroin, whatever, derivatives, then cut it again to the street level. By the late 60s, the price of dealing on the streets was not financial. The police and the mafia had their payoff already multifold. The price of being an undisrupted dealer, besides dealing their drugs at their price, was political information off the street. Who was doing what? So if you wanted to be a dealer, you also had to be a government informant. Okay? And that was the way they ran the system. And that's why the Panthers, H. Rep. Brown and a shootout with the drug dealers, the Panthers tried to get the drugs out of the community. Blacks plus drugs equals genocide was their pamphlet. Michael DeRiva Moore. So they know, I mean, the crack cocaine doesn't go into the majority of cocaine users are using this pure powder, and they're middle class white executives and well paid. They got the money. And the graffiti in New York is cocaine is God's way of telling you you're making too much money. But on the street, for the black and the Hispanic, it's the crack, the deadly drug. You know, it's developed in a different lab, but that's not just random chance. Blacks don't like crack and whites like powder. It's a whole system of what drug's going to be available and what damage will it do, which one's going to be the political nemesis, which one's allowed. You know, it's all control. They brought those heroin into the community in Watts in the 1920s right after they rioted, one of the earliest race riots. They brought the drugs in, the mafia, to calm them down. It's social control. It's like the opium wars in the British China and the colonial control there with the opium.
What about the Civil War? There was thought to abolish slavery.
Well, you might think a bunch of whites went out and fought each other to abolish slavery, but I think most black people know better than that.
The history books will tell you.
Yes,
that.
The history books will tell you.
What was the real reason of the war?
It was an economic war, essentially, between interests in the North and South over tariffs and, you know, production and what was going to sell in a certain way, you know. The Emancipation Proclamation was basically a very restricted document that said slavery ends in those areas controlled by the rebellious states. The non-rebellious states, there wasn't emancipation. It was just in the rebellious states. And the main reason they were doing that is they were hoping for black uprisings in the states, you know, where that was happening. They weren't winning the war for a long time. I mean, you know, they had pretty bad generals and things. But, I mean, you know, they'll tell you anything in a history book to distort what actually happened. But, you know, it's the real history of this country is
that's
just
the
history
really of privilege. That's where all the conspiracies, all that bullshit started.
Well, it starts with concentration of wealth, but the real big family money, which was government-backed, the robber barons in the 19th century then transmit into the Industrial Revolution. They buy the means of production and become the super-rich. But those family things, sometimes they came over even from England or elsewhere with the money and already a fortune to invest. But for a long time it was an open season because outside of the native population that we've discovered, there wasn't anything in the way between each coast for just, you know, flat out raw material grab. The way Gould and those guys had to make their fortunes after that first rush went through was that, like, Gould got a government domain 10 miles either side of a railroad that he built. He owned the land 10 miles either side of the railroad, so any town came up with the Railroad of Commerce, he owned all the property. And that was state protected, it was eminent domain. So a lot of these guys didn't rely on invention or you know, great intelligence, they relied on scams and government protection of their wealth.
And federal domination.
Took advantage of a moment. And Kennedy wealth comes from, you know, bad money too. And family. But the boys went against the father.
What do you think about what the FDA is, doing right now, trying to ban vitamins and herbs and stuff?
Well, I think it's similar to, you know, to the purges of witches and healers earlier. I mean, I think they want to maintain health as a profitable alternative, and they want people to lock themselves into, you know, the hospitals and the standard AMA health system, because they can charge you a lot more for that than it costs to take care of yourself. So I think it's basically just baseline profit motive, you know, to get you to go into, and then if you go into that system to take care of your health, you have to pay tremendous insurance, because one hospital visit can be tens of thousands of dollars. It'll break the back of 90% of the population to go to the hospital. So then you have to pay the insurance companies, and the insurance companies and the doctors then conspire to raise the prices of things in an escalating nightmare. So we're now to the point that, you know, you can't afford the medicine, you can't afford insurance, you can't afford anything. And then you get vast numbers of people disenfranchised from the medical system, but they don't have the knowledge about nutrients and about vitamins and health and self-healing that would make it possible for them to cut themselves off. Except in the, I mean, there are things that modern medicine can do with intervention that probably you couldn't do with herbal cures. Like if somebody's dying from years of cholesterol buildup and a vein is closed, and they do an intrusion and open the vein up, you know, let the blood back through, and otherwise the person within a certain number of hours has a stroke or dies. You know, but if the person had been eating healthy for those 20 years, then they wouldn't have the buildup. And you know what I mean? It's like they can probably come in on a crisis, but they can't compare to preventive, healthy approaches to life. So that's what I think it is. It's mostly just a profit motive. They don't want you to cure yourself.
Hi, my roommate in high school and college was Diane Russell, who's May's daughter. And I listened to a lot of her tapes, and May used to always say that she thought she was going to get it someday. And she was pretty healthy to me. And, you know, she died of cancer quite quickly. Man. I mean, do you feel that she was given cancer? And if so, you know.
Well, May had extensive files on cancer. Cancer was a weapon. It was studied as a weapon. They brought a specialist from Nazi Germany who had isolated cancer-causing viruses in the 1940s. Well, actually, in the 30s, I think he isolated the first one, about 36, but he worked on it in the 40s as a weapon for the Nazis. And he was brought to Fort Detrick, which was the main chemical and biological warfare testing area in the 50s. And did work there for about 2 years. Not all cancers are viral, but apparently, from what I was reading, vaginal cancers, which is supposedly what May had. I mean, we have to rely on these doctors at Stanford. She always talked about Stanford being a center of intelligence activity in her tapes, too. So a lot of people wanted her to use an alternative method for healing, and instead she went to back to the doctors at the end, and people were kind of surprised that she would, you know, rely on them. We don't know what real situation was. They diagnosed a tumor. They claimed, told her they removed the tumor, and 97% was gone. And they gave her some chemotherapy, and they said she'd go into remission. And she went back in there six weeks later or something after she had the last treatment, and they told her, your body's full of cancer. You're dead in six months most. And then she went into a hospice. So they could have planted cancer there. They certainly could have introduced these cancer-causing agents. David Ferry, the guy that figures into the Kennedy assassination, had hundreds of white rats in his apartment. He and Dr. Mary Sherman were injecting them with cancer cells and feeding them cancer cells to induce cancer. She wrote an article later on the results saying that they could induce it both ways in these rats in the Louisiana Medical Journal. And then she herself died very violently also. Both of them were murdered. In fact, accounts on her, that one account is that she was shot, another was that she was stabbed to death, and both accounts say she was burned alive. So, I mean, whatever she knew, they slammed it to her. And she was working with Ferry, and he was doing this testing. So I think they have ways to induce cancer. I had a great deal of evidence that the Kennedy kid whose leg was amputated, that in fact they either induced cancer in the leg sample or they substituted. There was no cancer in the leg. They cut the leg off, and then there was no cancer again. But in the interim, there was cancer, and they had a family doctor come in and take over. But the pathologist at the hospital that I spoke to told me something was fishy, that there wasn't any cancer in the leg. And I noticed about 6 months later, the Kennedys sent a commiserating letter, talked to some family whose kid had accidentally had his leg amputated for cancer when he didn't have it. So I think that may be, you know, what they did with that kid. 27 of the key witnesses in the Kennedy case died of cancer that lasted 6 weeks or less. Ruby died of very quick acting cancer. It was the same melanoma that Martha Mitchell had years later that killed her. Very rare melanoma, and I think it was probably injected. In both cases, she told her doctor they were injecting her with cancer. Ruby said he was getting painful shots. He didn't know what they were. And he dies of a lung cancer, and she dies of cancer, separated. So Bill Decker, the sheriff of Dallas, was present at the pickup of one of the extra bullets, knew a great deal else about the cover-up, went into the hospital in Dallas for a broken leg, and died 6 days later of cancer. I think they can induce a vast amount very quickly into the body and very deadly and kill you. They could have gotten to me through the water system. That was public. They could have gotten to the other ways, but there was no final autopsy. The family didn't want to do an extensive autopsy. We don't have any final proof that that's what happened, but cancer is a weapon, and May was a likely target. I think that if they killed May, the real thing that tipped it was the death of her dad and her mom just before, because I think, you know, the father was very important to the power structure, Rabbi Magnin, down there in LA, and he knew Nixon. And I think while he was alive, it's just a tip of the hat. You got a Meshuggah daughter, you know, let her talk, would discredit her, not kill her. But when he was gone, and then the mother shortly after, I don't think there was any reason then to leave her alive. I think they had motive, and they had a situation where they could do it with impunity. Whether they did it or not, I don't know, but we have to ask. The house across the street that was built, she was warned that they would build a spy house, an A-frame, it went up. 6 months later, she went over for sugar. There was no furniture. They only had taping machines. The whole time that I was packing her materials, they were pounding a building. Like, I thought they were building something over there, but now I realize they must have been emptying it. And the morning of her death, about 7 in the morning, the house caught fire and burned to the ground. And the Carmel Register, the Little Valley Register newspaper, had an article saying the fire chief would not release the names of the owners of the house, the tenants of the house, whether they were in the house at the time of the fire, or the cause of the fire. Now, what's the secret? Carmel, a little rich community, what's the difference? Who owned the house, unless it was something fishy? The guy had to be told not to release anything. And we went over and photographed, the cars were burned out nearby, we photographed the license plates, tried to track them down. One researcher said that there was an early title of the house that involved D. Howard Hunt. But whether they in fact did something, whether they can, and there's some indications I've seen in scientific literature that microwaves can induce cancer. So it could have been put that way. But you can't put it past them, but I'm just saying we never had any final proof. But May would have been suspicious.
Certainly. John, do you have some information about, you know, decentralization and what we can, you know, get educated on? And that's
well, there is a newsletter, Green Revolution, that comes out of School of Living, and you can write to me for the address, and I can get you that. And they're a decentralized journal. They've done a book on putting lands into trust. And they have some of Bersotti's writings on decentralism. And they also have stuff on alternate economies. Thomas Greco is another guy, if you can get anything written by him. He does a little newsletter, I think, called the Green Network or something. He's also part of something that goes on. Whenever they have the G7 meet, major economic powers of the world, the 7 big countries meet, they call them the G7. I told him the G stands for Grunch. It was this little title of Buckminster Fuller's last book, this little tiny book called Grunch, Gross Universal Cash Heist. is what it stands for. And, you know, he understood concentration of wealth and what it was doing, and he outlines in that book, but it's Grunch 7, but they call it G7, and they haven't toes. The other economic summit is an alternative economic summit for the disenfranchised, and they meet in the same city and try to get press for the alternative view. There's not enough out about decentralism, I mean, but there were early American decentralist writers and American anarchists that attempted to do things. Lysander Spooner is one in the 1850s, an American anarchist. At that time, the postage stamp had gotten up to 25 cents. And Lysander started the American Mail Company and used ponies and delivered the mail for 5 cents. So all the business went to him. He had a successful business and he ran it at a profit but didn't overcharge people. And the government had to pass a law, Congress had to pass a law that private firms couldn't deliver the mail in order to get the business back, but they were so embarrassed they had to charge 5 cents for almost 100 years until we forgot Lysander Spooner. Now they've got it back up to 29 cents. But there are many ways to do things cheaper than the government will do. And decentralism also puts people back in touch with the land. One guy on the philosophical level that's good to read is Wendell Berry. If you have any of his books, What Are People For? Or there's another one, I can't remember the title right now. It's something about the green consciousness. But he's a farmer, and he talks about the separation of society, which he thinks is fatal, between culture and agriculture, because they used to be mixed. But that connection to the land and to nature. There's also a movement for something called permaculture, which is living within the environment, like an ecologically balanced approach to building and all the production that you do that does that replenishes rather than harms. Mildred Loomis and Ralph Persody in the School of Living introduced organic gardening to J.R. Rodale in the 30s. And Rodale carried that out into a major campaign, Organic Gardening and Farming magazine. And that's very important too, all the lands being eroded and devalued. So there's many aspects, but the most important one, I think, is to get people back in touch with deciding about their own lives. I think if democracy has a meaning, real democracy has a meaning, the word means that the people who make decisions about things that affect their lives are the people being affected. In other words, that democracy's goal would be to have everyone affected by a particular decision participate in that decision. And if that's a real definition of democracy, I think it is, you can see how far removed we are from what democracy should or could be. Because most of us live our lives in, like Thoreau said, desperation, where our decisions are made outside of our hands and without any knowledge. And we have a horrible educational system. It's mostly a propaganda system. And now it doesn't even educate you how to read or tremendous illiteracy. They don't want anyone to know anything. In fact, the FBI has a program to ask librarians who's taking out what books in the library now. They want to know who's reading certain things. So it's really a subversive activity now to read, besides being a lost art after television. But there's a lot out there if you want to read it. Dulles said of the Warren Commission stuff, go ahead and print the evidence, nobody will read it anyway.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you had any information about the Rajneesh movement. It was a very interesting.
I felt that the guy that heading up the Rajneesh movement was under control of that family that brought him in. They paid his way in and they supported him for a long time. And the woman, Ma Ananda, I think was the name, was part of that family and really I thought was the control. I thought that the long silence or the blissed out state was actually a drug state that they had him in and that he was under their manipulation and control. He may have had some consciousness, he may have been some sort of a guru in India that developed himself, but I think the sponsorship by this, I think it's a British family that brought him in. And that woman, as far as I could tell, was very evil, very manipulative within the group. She was the one that was going to poison the water supply in that town in Oregon so everyone would be homesick on voting day and they could vote themselves into political office. And you know, she had also conspired to kill some of the people in the community. I was very suspicious of the nationwide recruitment by bus of homeless people. And the homeless were eventually dumped back out in the street in these little towns in Oregon that couldn't even deal with them. They didn't have bus fare.
Why was he ousted?
They were ousted, I felt, because they complained. They were brought in and they were being given injections. They didn't know what they were. I felt that it was recruitment for mind control. I have an article from the American Psychiatric Association Journal. The California Psychiatric Association gave them a sort of seal of approval as an alternate psychiatric facility for these homeless people. And knowing what I know of the psychiatric profession, they wouldn't do that if these people weren't drugging them to a large extent. They were given something to drink each day. They were told were beer, and they said it wasn't beer. Didn't taste like it. 1,000 of them tried to bring a class suit. 1,000 of the homeless that were brought there because they felt that they'd been manipulated or drugged or made sick by what they were being given there. And it got no press attention. I don't think it ever made it to court before the thing blew up. There were some local reporters, and I think it's called the Oregon Beacon or something like that, a little local newspaper up there in the town, that started to do an expose similar to the Jonestown stuff right before they broke. And they had a series of good articles about the manipulation going on. I also thought it was significant that Patricia Ryan, or not Patricia Ryan, the other Ryan daughter, Congressman Ryan had killed at Jonestown in Pucatuma. His daughter was part of that organization, just sort of rolling in his grave. But, you know, I don't know.